This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 29 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
David, we have some great topics for this episode. I think, once again, there's more FAA references than chickens at a Purdue farm, but we also have some new players we're going to talk about. But first, I understand we have some breaking news that just came out as we started recording.
Yeah, I got a tweet that referenced motherboard.com, and the headline reads, and this is dated real time, March 6, 2014 at 6:51 p.m., commercial drones are completely legal. A federal judge ruled. Well, our buddy Perker, who was the only person fined $10,000 for flying his drone, has had his case thrown out. Brendan Schuman, who fought the case and the lawyer, was saying that the FAA has never regulated model aircraft and that its entire basis for making them illegal, a 2007 policy notice, was not legally binding. The FAA has never undertaken the required public notice necessary to make an official regulation. So, Max, what we've been talking about recently about the FAA not doing anything, well, now we've got the court saying they didn't do anything. So, interesting. Motherboard, part of their comment was, what this means for now, quote, you can go fly your drone and charge whatever the hell you want to do it. Beer delivery drones are legal, so is everything else. That means that all of those companies that have been harassed by the FAA, drink, have at least for the moment nothing to worry about. The FAA could potentially try to establish an emergency rule, but it's unclear how long that will take or whether they will do it. Wow. This is big news.
Yeah, and I imagine that it would probably be wise not to draw too many conclusions yet. I think we probably need a little bit of analysis as to just, you know, what the ruling exactly means. Right now, we're seeing it sort of filtered through the eyes of the initial news reports. And certainly, David, as we've seen many times before in aviation, they don't quite get it right the first time. So I wouldn't advise anyone to run out and start, opening up their doors to a commercial operation at this point, but keep your eyes open, and we'll be certainly talking about this as we go forward. So that's sort of the unplanned news of the episode. David, what are we looking at for the other things that we had planned on?
If we're going to continue with the FAA, the FAA released a Busting Myths about UAVs. The FAA authority to regulate UASs is questioned, which those two articles dovetail together nicely. And then we go off the deep end, like Facebook bought Titan Aircraft, a drone company, and the law of unexpected consequences appears when, do we have enough communication bandwidth for all of these drones flying around? There's going to be an international UAV test consortium and no UFO training, but UAV training at Roswell. And lastly, hopefully, if we can get around to it, privacy questions flare up down on the Australian continent. And Russia's everybody's bad guy this week is actually licensed to build Israeli UAVs. Supports the argument the Israelis will sell the UAV technology to anybody, unlike the United States, who have regulations. So we'll have to talk about that. The first article is from one of our Facebook followers, Marvin. Marvin sent us, Facebook follows Amazon, Google into drones with a $6 million purchase. And this was from Forbes.com.
$60 million purchase.
What did I say, 600 million?
No, you said six. Either way, it's pretty inexpensive, I think.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because we talked about Titan in one of the earlier episodes and the fact that Titan Aerospace makes a HAL, high altitude, long endurance, solar-powered UAV that they talked about persistent solar atmospheric satellites. Interestingly enough, Max, I noticed that now that persistent solar atmospheric satellites that we talked about earlier suddenly has TM after it. So somewhere along the line, that became a trademark.
Yeah, they're trying to capture that as a trademark. When I first saw this, David, my first reaction was, why is Facebook getting into this kind of a business? But when you look at it, it starts to make a little bit of sense, because Facebook is one of the partners in something called internet.org, and their objective is they want to bring everyone in the world with a smartphone into what they call the knowledge economy by making internet services a lot cheaper, like 100 times cheaper, and which is a very lofty goal, right? There are certainly many billions of people on the earth who have internet connectivity and also many who do not. And so what they'd like to do, this organization would like to do, is make that feasible and affordable and available. And it's an interesting group. Not only does it include Facebook, but it also includes Samsung, Ericsson, MediaTek, Nokia, Opera, that's Opera, the browser company, I would imagine, and Qualcomm. And so when you look at it from that standpoint, having these persistent aerial satellites being able to offer connectivity, that begins to make a little bit of sense. Now I can see what Facebook is up to.
All I can think of when I think about this is a bunch of people running over a hill singing, "I'd like to teach the world to like in perfect harmony. I'd like to buy the world a laptop and keep them company." So anybody who knows the old Coca-Cola commercial, it's peace, love, and internet now instead of peace, love, and happiness. So, and remember, when we talked about the Titan's kind of impressive because they want it to fly up to 5 years on solar power,
right,
above the commercial traffic. It flies a consistent orbit over whatever, and we talked about how great this would be if it was a disaster area, but this is thinking even more bigger, how great it would be for places that don't have cell phone towers. You just have this orbit, and this is not a little airplane. This will be an interesting to see what actually comes of it, whether Zuckerberg's $60 million will actually make something happen or not.
I think this is a cheaper way to provide coverage, internet coverage, rather than cell towers. Cell towers are very expensive, and especially in remote areas, in underdeveloped areas of the world where the road infrastructure may not be very good. That makes it even more difficult. But if you can fly one of these things or have one of these things orbiting up above and providing that that same functionality that a cell tower would, that's a much less expensive way to do that. One of the interesting things I found out in looking at this is the chairman and CEO of Titan Aerospace is Vern Rayburn. If that name sounds familiar, Vern was the founder and CEO of Eclipse Aviation. So interesting, this is where Vern Rayburn has landed. So it'll be interesting to watch. Yeah, as you mentioned, David, there may be altruistic social motivations for providing this kind of service to the world, but at the same time, the companies that are partners in this certainly stand to benefit from the business that it would create.
And speaking of bandwidth and business, This was my favorite article of the week, was drones seen driving spectrum sharing technologies. This was from DefenseSystems.com, and something we really haven't talked about is bandwidth and integrating how much bandwidth all of these remotely piloted vehicles and UAVs and UASs need, and finding specific bands for different purposes. If you are part of a model airplane club and you're at a flying field for a model airplane club, 90% of the time you're box where the box that you use to fly the airplane is locked up in a cabinet, or a good club will do that. And the reason being is they don't want your box with the same frequency to interfere with the airplane that the guy is flying out in the field. And this goes for radio control cars. Usually the radio control cars come with multiple frequencies so you can race them. Well, if you start having UAVs controlling the skies, what frequencies are going to be for small UAVs? What frequencies are going to be for large UAVs? And how are they going to interconnect with frequencies on the for the normal aviation spectrums?
Right. And here, this is not an issue that the FAA gets to decide. This is under the purview, in the U.S. anyway, of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. They control frequencies. And there's a quote in the article from an FCC chief engineer who says, "We have a lot of work ahead of us on identifying exactly what the needs are." So while we have the FAA trying to figure out what the regulations are, this is another aspect of developing commercial UAVs in great numbers that has to be figured out. We just have to have the communications, the command and control, sensing data, real-time video, all that communication between a UAV and the ground. The bandwidth has to be there to support it.
So this is something I think you and I need to follow up on and keep an eye on and see what the FCC comes up with. Because this is one of those cans of worms that once you start opening it up, it's going to be very interesting. Our friend Mary Kirby likes connectivity and KU bands and all of that lingo. And I have a feeling that we're going to start talking about specific frequencies and such, even with UAVs. So I'm looking forward to following this story, because it's one of those unseen consequences that occur in the background that you don't really anticipate for.
Absolutely.
So maybe they'll figure out how to do that in the new test sites that are international, huh, Max?
Yeah, this was very interesting. We had talked about the test sites before, obviously the six test sites identified by the FAA in the United States. And one of the things we mentioned on this show previously, or the issue we raised, is, well, what about the rest of the world? And shouldn't there be a sharing of information and the development of the guidelines and rules and so forth on a more global basis? And we see in the Ottawa Citizen, this article is titled "International Consortium of Aeronautical Test Sites for UAVs Announced in Quebec." So this is an international consortium, and it's been created to share information on things like operational safety and flight regulations and operational experiences. And this is all intended to enable development, testing, and certification of unmanned aerial systems and remotely piloted aircraft systems. They also are looking to support the creation of international standards for those UAVs. So I think this is a great move. This is a good step.
It's interesting, though, that it's not one of the six sites for the United States, Oklahoma State University. But it will be interesting to see how the internet, whether our six test sites feed into this or vice versa, and hopefully the communication will spread out quicker. I also noticed that Wales is involved, but technically Great Britain isn't, where the two test sites that they had set up was. So it's even further expansion of the mentality that we need to test.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, David, Oklahoma State University was involved in this announcement. We also have the UAV Test and Service Center in France. In Wales, as you mentioned, the National Aeronautical Center. And in Quebec, the Unmanned Aerial Systems Center of Excellence. And the article notes that they expect that other centers around the world will join in the consortium over time. So that's another good one to watch for.
So let's go to one of my all-time favorite places on the planet, Roswell, New Mexico.
Ah.
We're going to talk about not UFOs, but UAVs. Strategic Aerospace International has been trying to develop a drone pilot center, and they're going to use it in Roswell, New Mexico. We talked about the Northrop Grumman's Sand Shark, which was the disposable UAV. You know, here we'll get, where Northrop Grumman proposed to the Air Force that we'll give you a UAV that you can crash so you can learn how to fly and you won't be crashing Reapers and Predators. So Strategic Aerospace is setting up a flight center in Roswell with 30 Air Force Academy graduates in a 90-day or a 3-month program, huh?
Strategic Aerospace International has training classes that it's set up at a number of universities, I think 48 colleges and universities. But the problem is that doesn't give them a place to actually fly UAVs as part of a training program. So what SAI has done is work with the folks in New Mexico who are excited to do this because of the potential economic value and jobs and so forth that it brings, to set up this facility in New Mexico where students can go and conduct the sort of the flight training part of UAV pilot training. That sounds great. I wonder if they've checked with the FAA. Although now, after this this item that we talked about, maybe they don't need to.
You said that basically that you've made the analogy that the UAV industry now is the wild, wild west. Well, the first gunshots were just fired to really charge down into the wild west. Like they started off with the land grabs in the 1700s where everybody lined up at the thing and the starter gun went off and you went out to try to get your stake in the UAV world. So I think the gun just went off today.
Yes, and we'll put a link in the show notes. There is a video. It's a 13-minute video on the Strategic Alliance website that goes into more detail about just exactly what it is they're setting up there and what the facilities look like and so forth. They also expect that the first classes will start in May, or they hope that they'll start in May. And they're also expecting that in the future they'll be able to expand this so that anyone can apply for this training. That sounds great, and hope they're successful at doing that.
All right. Well, now everybody get out your shot glasses, because here comes the big story of the night. John, one of our listeners, who says, originally from Connecticut, now in South Carolina with the DJI Phantom 2 Vision, sent us busting myths about the FAA and unmanned aircraft. The FAA early this week, posted a list of myths that have come out of, you know, in a way, Max, it sounds like they were prepping for this decision.
I know it does.
I don't know if it's timing or they had an inkling, and they gave us 7 myths and facts, and then we're going to talk about an article that came out that sort of dispels these myths and facts. Or
he tries to. Yeah, some of them. And again, the link to this FAA piece will be in the show notes, and you may want to take a look at it. We only have time to sort of touch on it a little bit here, but the first myth, for example, is that the FAA doesn't control airspace below 400 feet. And the FAA says, no, not true. In fact, they control all of the airspace. The second myth is that commercial UAS flights are okay if I'm on private property and stay below 400 feet. And the FAA says, no, that's not true. And again, references the same thing you did earlier, David, that 2007 Federal Register notice that says, no, you can't. There's some other myths. Commercial UAS operations are a gray area, quote, in FAA regulations. And the FAA says, no, there is no gray. It's very specific.
It's black and white.
It's black and white.
This one I like because we've talked about this one. There are too many commercial UAS operations for the FAA to stop. In fact, the FAA is watching and has appropriate enforcement tools. Well, clearly fining doesn't work because that just got thrown out the window. Commercial UAS operations will be okay after September 30th, 2015. Fact, Congress mandated the FAA come up with safe integration plan by that date. Regulations, policies, and standards will come incrementally, meaning that They ain't going to be done on September 30th, but they will be worked on. So, and myth number six, the FAA is lagging behind other countries in approving commercial drones. Fact, the U.S. is not like the rest of the world. There's a profound statement. We have a very busy airspace and we need to get this right, which is sort of, I think that's throwing a softball at that argument.
A little bit, but it is true. And they point out that, for example, the United States has way more general aviation activity than most other countries. And so, you know, the number of aircraft up there is much larger. There are many, many more airports than in most other countries. And so it's a bigger, aviation scene than we see elsewhere. In effect, they're saying that other countries, they have an easier time of this because they're smaller, they have less volume. We're big, we have all this flying activity, and so it's a much more complex issue, and we're not going to forgo safety in the interests of being fast with the regulations.
And myth number seven, this one is really interesting. The FAA predicts as many as 30,000 drones by 2030. The fact is, that's an outdated number. Now the FAA estimates 7,500 UASs by 2018. So it's interesting they're backpedaling on the scope of the issue. And so that's interesting. And that brings us to an article from Slate.com. And I got this from a lot of people this week with the, did you see this? And basically the article was, free the beer drones. Maybe the FAA doesn't have the authority to regulate unmanned aerial vehicles.
Yeah, and this is kind of timely. Well, the author of this article believes that the U.S. code and the regulations that give the FAA authority do not define UAVs, so they have no authority. The code, the U.S. code that establishes the FAA speaks to manned aircraft, is silent on unmanned aircraft. So his conclusion is, therefore, the FAA doesn't have authority to regulate something that they're not given authority to regulate.
Which is something that you and I have also said in the past about the how can you enforce something that you're not sure what you're enforcing? So it's a broader scope argument than what was in the verdict that came out today about it was a radio-controlled airplane. Therefore, the FAA has never regulated radio-controlled airplanes, so why would they start now? All of this sort of ties together, and next week, Max and I, I'm sure, will be scratching our heads because the murky waters will have probably gone black by that point.
Yeah, and I think that, yeah, after another week of looking at this, today's news, we'll be able to speak a little more intelligently about it.
But we do that?
Yeah, we can try.
I thought that's why everybody listened to us, was the comedy, because we don't know what we're talking about.
But meanwhile, take a look at this article. It's kind of interesting. He also says that even if the FAA does have authority, he says it has not published the documents required to regulate UAVs. And that, you know, the way this works is that in order to create regulations, in order to create statutory law, you have to have public scrutiny. You have to have the ability for the public to contribute and make comments on this. And that's the way the FAA works with everything else, except in this area of UAS, where there has been no public input in that whole part of the process. So interesting points.
Another one to follow up on.
We got an item from Rob from Perth, Western Australia. This is from ABC. AFP using drones to investigate major crime as questions raised over privacy. So the AFP is the Australian Federal Police, and they have a parliamentary inquiry down there, and they're looking at drones and their use by the AFP. Now, the AFP says that their use has been limited, like flying over crime scenes and things like that. And they do say that before they can conduct any covert surveillance, it would require them to get a warrant. But the Office of the Privacy Commissioner also is noted in this article as saying that they're getting a lot of inquiries from the public about the use of drones and about concerns for privacy. So that issue is going to keep coming up, and we're seeing it come up here in Australia.
Yeah, and there were some interesting comments. One of them on the article was, quote, criminals have no right, so stuff their privacy. If this enables more dirtbags to be put behind bars where they truly belong, good. Well, clearly there's somebody out there who is for pro-drone use. So let's talk a little bit about technology exchange. We've talked about Russia and China trying to play catch up to the United States and Israel. Well, one way to quickly catch up is when Israel sends Russia a license to build their Searcher 2 UAVs. It's a half-ton aircraft with a 20-hour endurance, so that would be a MAIL, medium altitude. Can operate up to 300 kilometers per from the operator, and it can carry a 264-pound payload. So it's not a little or small UAV. It's a medium-sized UAV in the class of a Predator, and Russia is getting the technology directly from Israel, which is kind of unique.
And apparently this wasn't just a quick decision to do this. The article says that they've been negotiating and conducting trials of the Searcher for 7 years. So this has been something that's taken a long time. But I guess we'll start to see Russian Searcher 2 UAVs coming off the assembly line there.
So, Max, it looks like it's that time of the week that we like, the video of the week. And this is from Eric in Northwest Oregon. First of all, he said, keep up the good work on all the podcasts. And he sent us a video from nature.com where it was autonomous drones flock like birds, which is really kind of cool. It's more of a mechanical video, not the gorgeous scenes that we saw last week with over the boats and landscapes. But a group in Hungary have got a bunch of drones to take off from fields like you would see a flock of birds. You know, they sort of scatter and then they join up and they're flying in formation autonomously. So if you watch Canada geese here in the States, somebody takes the lead and the rest of them follow, and then they switch leads and such. So it's an interesting video of the week, and shows an interesting set of technology. How it might come about and be practical in the future, I don't know. But definitely an interesting video.
All right, great. And thanks, Eric, for sending that in.
And last but not least, from one of our co-hosts down under, Grant McCarron, Williams Foundation, a local think tank of ex-military types, as he wrote, have recommended Australia fast tracks to purchase some more UAVs. So we'll put that link in the show notes for some more Australian news. And wow, that was awfully quick, 30 minutes, huh, Max?
It always goes quickly. But we'd like to thank all of you for listening to the UAV Digest. This has been episode 29. You can find show notes at theuavdigest.com, or you can use the shortcut, theuavdigest.com/29, to get to episode 29 directly.
And don't forget to check us out on Facebook. Leave us some feedback there, or email us at feedback@theuavdigest.com. If you're on iTunes, definitely leave us some feedback or listen or stream us to your phone via Stitcher.com. And coming soon, we'll actually have a cafe press site set up for the UAV Digest, so you can get some UAV Digest swag.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to, I'm working on getting the UAV Digest shot glass out to everybody so they can follow along with our infamous little drinking game.
Fantastic. Hey, we'd also like to thank Go Engineer for sponsoring this episode. Learn more about them at theuavdigest.com/goengineer.
Well, until next week and more breaking news about the FAA and UAVs, this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening, folks.